This is episode 60 of the Fifth Estate podcast, Mike Resendiz on investigative journalism and the movie Spotlight.
A lot of us get excited for summer because it means going on vacation or spending long days at the beach, maybe taking the kids to an amusement park. But you know what gets a burglar excited for summer? Knowing that you'll do all those things and leave your house empty. Summer is prime time for burglary. So now's the time to protect your home. For a limited time, you can take a whopping $100 off SimpliSafe's special summer package. This is SimpliSafe's biggest ever summer sale. It has everything you need to protect your home. An arsenal of security sensors to secure each door and window. Your SimpliSafe system comes with a panic button, a blaring extra siren, and a wireless connection to authorities and police dispatch. Your family, your home, and everything in it stays safe around the clock. With SimpliSafe, there are no long-term contracts, no installation costs, and no hidden fees. And 24/7 professional monitoring is just $14.99 a month. This summer, see what SimpliSafe can do for your home. Get $100 off your summer security package at simplisafe.com/ricochet. Hurry! This offer ends soon. That's simplisafe.com/ricochet to get your $100 off. That's spelled SimpliSafe.com. simplisafe.com/ricochet for $100 off your purchase.
All right, it's time for another episode of the Fifth Estate Podcast. My name is Jay Caruso. I am here along with my co-host, Mr. Neil Dewing.
Yes, you are, Jay. Yes, you are. And everyone else is here with me, too.
Everyone else? Who's that?
All the listeners, Jay. All our many fine listeners.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yeah, we want to make sure that they're here. So that is definitely a good thing. So... as you know, before we get started here, as always, we implore our listeners to go out to iTunes, give us a rating, tell us how much you like us, all that good stuff, right?
I've stopped imploring them. I think I moved on to beseeching them.
Well, that works too. Beseeching is fine as well.
Yeah. So. I mean, as long as the five stars, you know, start to appear. And I think they will. I think, you know, the talent on display in this show is it's pretty much a foregone conclusion.
Yeah.
We're going to get some five star reviews.
Absolutely. So, you know, with the age of Trump, investigative journalism has become kind of a, you know, there's been not an increase in it, I should say, but more of a focus on investigative journalism, especially surrounding all the many different scandals and everything going on from the election. So,
yeah, it's certainly very consequential.
Yeah, it certainly is. And, you know, so we wanted to kind of have a discussion about this. And we've had reporters on the show before and everything else, but we haven't had an investigative reporter. And so tonight on this show, we do have an investigative reporter. And if any of you out there have seen the movie Spotlight, Mark Ruffalo portrayed this character in the film, and he's here with us tonight. Mike Resendiz of the Boston Globe and the Spotlight team, thank you for joining us.
Thanks again, Mike. And, you know, just to get us kind of started off, could you maybe tell us a little bit about your background, you know, where you started out in journalism and where you've worked?
Sure. I've been on the Globe Spotlight team on and off, but mostly on for about 15 years, and I've worked at the Globe for more than 20 years. So before that, I worked, just going backwards, I worked at the Washington Post. Not a lot of reporters would leave a staff job at the Washington Post for the Boston Globe, but I did. And before that, I worked at the San Jose Mercury News out in California. And before that, I worked for the Alternative Press. I worked for the late lamented Boston Phoenix. And I started out at a small crusading, rabble-rousing weekly newspaper in a low-income neighborhood in Boston called East Boston. And I was a volunteer reporter there when I was still at Boston University. And when I graduated, they offered me the job of editor, and that was my first paid job in journalism. And it was a great job and a great introduction to the craft.
That's interesting. You know, I always enjoy reading sort of the alternative weeklies. You know, they're kind of scarce on the ground these days, but we have one where I am in Norfolk. And actually, I think it changed its name. It used to be, I think it's now on the website. It's like All Daily or something. But the Alternative Press, I've always found that to be kind of interesting. Did you find it a little more liberating writing in the Alternative Press?
Yeah, I thought I didn't appreciate how talented I was and everyone else in the room was at the Boston Phoenix. And everyone I worked with went on to bigger jobs in the news business. There are a lot of people here at the Globe who worked at the Boston Phoenix. Charlie Pierce, who writes for Esquire magazine, worked with me at the Boston Phoenix. A lot of real success stories came out of there. And we just ran a great newspaper. And it was terrific to have a lot of space. It was terrific to sort of combine our analysis with reporting. It was a bit unconventional for that time, but today it's very, very conventional. So I found it to be a terrifically creative time of my life and career.
Well, let me ask you in relation to that. You know, what since you worked at, you know, these kind of smaller local papers, what is your view, kind of, before we get into more of the questions about investigative journalism, what's your take on the newspaper industry, especially as it relates to more local coverage?
Well, I'll tell you, I think there's a real crisis in local journalism, and it's a real threat to democracy across the country. You know, I think it's fantastic that the Washington Post has been revitalized because of Marty Baron and Jeff Bezos. I think it's fantastic that the New York Times has more than 2 million online subscribers. It's just inspiring to see these two pillars of American journalism thriving in this environment. However, they have economic models that are not replicable by other papers. And I think what's happening in most of the country is that newspapers, news organizations, I should say, have fallen on very hard times, and they're cutting the number of reporters, and they're cutting their investigative staffs. And I think it's not good for American society. I think it's not good for American democracy. So while we all are having a great deal of enjoyment, even awe, watching the New York Times and the Washington Post compete for scoops and cover the Trump administration like a blanket, I think everywhere else the situation looks fairly bleak. One area of hope that I see is the growing prevalence of online, nonprofit, donor-based or subscription-based news organizations that are really picking up the slack in a lot of different parts of the country. And also in places like New York, where you have ProPublica, and Washington, where you have the Center for Public Integrity, Bay Area, where you have the Center for Investigative Reporting. These are terrific news organizations. They're doing great work. And they have a completely different economic model that I think offers some hope for people around the country.
So, Mike, let's move into the discussion about sort of the investigative reporting. And first off, how does investigative reporting differ from, say, you know, your beat reporter, you know, guy just doing the daily reporting?
Well, in a way, I don't care for the term investigative reporting because I think all reporters should be investigative. I think one way to see the difference is often beat reporters will report on the news of the day, for instance, what the mayor said today or what the governor said today. But I would suggest that those beat reporters are not really taking enough initiative. Rather than just engage in what I consider to be glorified stenography, these reporters who are on the beat day after day, it's their responsibility to, as we used to say and still say, question authority. I think it's the responsibility of daily beat reporters to be investigative reporters and not take what's handed to them and simply type it up and put it in a news story. So I think the difference should not be that great. Of course, we also think as investigative reporters of having the luxury of time to look into problems that they see. And I think that is very important. You know, I take a lot of time to do a project these days, and I'm grateful that the Boston Globe allows me to do that and is still very committed to investigative reporting, even though we've suffered financially just like other metropolitan newspapers around the country. So I think an investigative reporter generally hopefully has more time and maybe more resources to investigate mm-hmm. something.
How much time would you say it takes for a really, you know, good story to unfold? Like, for instance, the story that was featured in the movie Spotlight, which is about the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church in Boston. And you're actually, it was more about the investigation and uncovering the information. How long did that play out in real life?
Well, I gotta say that was the initial investigation was pretty quick. I mean, we spent 5 months in doing the initial investigation. The movie, which is quite accurate, the movie is 2 hours long and conflates a 5 month investigation into about 120 minutes. And we were interrupted by 9/11 for probably a month. So, if you subtract all the time we spent on 9/11, it's really a 4 month investigation. It's pretty incredible considering what we turned up. Of course, the movie ends on the morning of the day we published the first story. And that initial 5 month investigation led to four blockbuster stories in January of 2002. But then we added to our team of four. We became a team of eight, and we continued investigating and just covering the explosion that we created. And we published another 600 stories over the course of a year before Cardinal Law finally resigned as the Archbishop of Boston and fled to the Vatican. So initial investigation was 4 or 5 months, depending on how you want to count it. But then we kept going for another year, and even longer than that, really.
It's amusing to me that you say like a 4 month investigation was quick, because Jay and I, we both come from, you know, the blogging world, where if it happened yesterday, it's old news a lot of times, and your cut at it might be outdated. So it's kind of funny that 4 months would be quick.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I mean, I've done projects that have taken a year. And again, I'm grateful to the Boston Globe for allowing me to take that long to do a project. But sometimes it just takes that long to get to the bottom of things and assemble a 4 or 5 or 6-part series of, let's say, 4,500 words a piece. Now, you know, I'm a big fan of the blogosphere, but I got to say there's a real difference between what in-depth investigative reporting produces, which is really fact-based journalism, and a lot of blogs that I listen to, which are really opinion. There's a big difference between opinion and fact-based journalism.
No, absolutely agree with that. So speaking of length, so when you're talking about, like, you're putting together an investigative report that you may have a piece that's, you know, I went and did a word count on, believe it or not, on the first spotlight piece about the abuse scandal, and it was about 4,500 words. How long does it take you to kind of put that together, or at least like your first run through?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it takes a different amount of time probably with each project. I mean, that particular story, that was unique. I mean, I gotta say that I was on fire when I wrote that, and still I probably took several days to write it, and then there were suggested revisions by other members of the Spotlight team, so I can't remember exactly, to tell you the truth, but it was probably over a week. Now, you know, when I sit down to write a long story, I've generally done a lot of reporting, and I've written an outline, and I like to go over an outline with an editor before I start to write. So I might take two weekends and a week to produce the first draft of, say, a 4,500 word story, something like that.
Okay. And so, you know, we talked about the 9/11 attacks kind of interrupting the story about the abuse scandal. So have there been other occasions? Like, how do you deal, like, let's say, you know, you want to time a story for impact, I would imagine, or sometimes, or there's certain factors that create a time frame for when you're going to report it. But how do you deal with something when other events come along or something else happens? How does that you know, do you put the brakes on? How easy is it to do that and then move on to something else and then come back? How does that work?
Well, it's different every time, depending on which stories are in play. I mean, 9/11, of course, was a super extraordinary situation. I mean, by the time 9/11 happened, we were pretty convinced we were onto a huge story about the Catholic Church. And to have such a big story in Catholic Boston, the most Catholic city in the United States, the idea that that could be interrupted by anything was just kind of crazy. And then along comes 9/11, and you're watching TV at 8 o'clock in the morning as a jet plane goes into the World Trade Center, and you know that you're going to be covering this story because the planes have left from Logan Airport right here in Boston. And there was just there wasn't even any discussion. It just everybody accepted the fact that we were going to have to go cover this story. There was no question about it. Some of our sources, some of the victims we've been talking, were bitterly disappointed, as you see in the movie. I mean, that's a true scene, but we just we had to do it, and I'm glad we did it. It was the right thing to do. We wrote some really great, important stories. And then we got back to our mission, and I have to say, you know, I think in the final analysis, everything worked out. I mean, I think publishing in early January was just worked out very, very well. You know, none of us knew this at the time. I don't know if either of you are Catholic, but we published on January 6th of 2002, and in the Catholic religion, that's known as Epiphany Sunday.
Yeah.
So I think we were... unwittingly given the Catholic Church a very big epiphany on Epiphany Sunday.
So, Mike, I outside of that particular investigative story that you did, what other one that you've done over time kind of really stands out for you that you say, okay, this one is maybe a little bit different than some of the other ones we've done?
Well, fairly recently I did an investigation that I am proud of because it had such beneficial results for a lot of people. I investigated an institution called Bridgewater State Hospital. Bridgewater State Hospital it's a misnomer, it's spin, it's propaganda, whatever you want to call it. It's not a hospital, it's a state prison for men who are severely mentally ill. It's not licensed as a hospital, it's not accredited as a hospital, it is in fact a medium security prison. And I got interested in Bridgewater because I discovered that there was a 23-year-old young man there who had never been convicted of a crime who was killed by guards. And I say killed by guards because ultimately his death was ruled a homicide. And even though his death was ruled a homicide, nothing was done about it. There was no one was disciplined. No one was reprimanded. The Department of Corrections simply put out a statement that everything had been done according to standard procedure. And I just thought that was kind of wild that you could have a finding of a homicide and have no one held accountable. What I discovered is that there was video evidence of the guards' terrible treatment of this individual. And not only that, but there was a cover-up of his death by the entire Department of Correction bureaucracy. So I investigated, I put 4 or 5 months into that and exposed the cover-up and the tragic death of this young man. And as a result, the governor immediately suspended 3 of the guards, and he fired a bureaucrat in the Department of Correction who was... had played a role in the cover-up. She signed the documents overturning an internal affairs investigation, and he formally reprimanded the commissioner and the superintendent of the prison. And I think, you know, a lot of reporters and a lot of news organizations would probably have declared victory and moved on. But I had a notion that this was happening a lot. This young man was killed while guards were trying to wrestle him into what are called 4-point restraints. That means you're strapped down to a bed by your wrists and ankles. And this is a procedure that has been widely discredited for the last decade all over the United States. And in fact, there's a movement among mental health professionals and people who run facilities like Bridgewater to stop using 4-point restraints and also solitary confinement altogether. And I had a hunch that four-point restraints were being used quite often at Bridgewater State Hospital. And so I was able to find out that two other men died at Bridgewater because of the use of four-point restraints. And after a long battle with the bureaucracy, I was able to get the information that proved that the guards at Bridgewater State Hospital were using seclusion and four-point restraints at a rate 100 times greater, literally, than any other mental health facility in Massachusetts. And they were using these techniques at rates exponentially higher than similar facilities in other parts of the country. So in addition, the local prosecutor did not investigate, obviously, and took a pass on the entire incident. But after my stories came out, the state attorney general appointed a special prosecutor to investigate, and the special prosecutor ultimately got a grand jury to indict three of the guards, and they're scheduled to stand trial later this year. But I think even more important, there were sweeping reforms at this facility, Bridgewater. The governor of Massachusetts approved a pretty expensive reform plan. As a result, there are no more prison guards inside Bridgewater. The prison guards have been replaced by a private force of specially trained security personnel. These folks are trained in how to deal with people who have a severe mental illness who may become more violent. And as a result, this institution is a much safer, much more humane institution. And I think that's that's something I'm very proud of.
Yeah, it's a great example of, you know, the power of journalism to actually change things. Mike, as a reporter, as a journalist, you know, what kind of stories grab you? You know, does it stories about injustice, abuse of power, do those tend to get you sink their hooks into you a little bit more, or what really drives you?
Yeah, I think you hit it right. I mean, stories where I see that there's an injustice for a large number of people, a large class of people, when I see that there's, or I get a notion or a hunch that there's some systemic injustice, then I do get kind of turned on by that sort of a story. I feel a sense of mission about those kinds of stories. And, starting with the clergy sex abuse investigation and, of course, this investigation into Bridgewater State Hospital. I've also been part of investigations into abuses in the debt collection industry, the overall mental health care system in Massachusetts. So I guess I do tend to gravitate to stories where people are seeking justice. I do tend to gravitate towards stories where there's a group of people who have been abused and who are voiceless. You know, I do think it's the job of journalists to provide justice to people who are seeking it and haven't had any, and also to give a voice to people who haven't had one.
Oh, that's great. It's good to see, you know, and it, and like Neil said, it's great to see that there are times when journalism can bring about some real change. So that's great to hear. Okay, so let's
yeah, true. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Mike. Absolutely, go ahead.
Well, I just want to say about the Bridgewater story, you know, I think I published 30 stories, you know, made those changes happen. You know, and in the case of the clergy sex abuse investigation, as I said, we published more than 600 stories. So part of making change is staying on the story and following up and keeping the investigation going, and not just, as I said earlier, you know, declaring victory when you got a scalp on the wall, maybe some official is fired. You know, you really have to stay on it until you get the results that this a particular class of aggrieved people deserves.
I agree. So, Mike, let's turn to the Spotlight movie. And obvious question, of course, is, you know, Mark Ruffalo portrayed your character, and what did you think? What was it like looking at yourself on the screen?
Well, it was a pretty surreal experience. I mean, it was my life, and it's hard to describe. It was a kind of an out of body experience seeing the rough cut of the film. But I think the filmmakers did a wonderful job. I think all of us on the Spotlight team know that we're very, very lucky that such talented people came along to make this story. I mean, it's particularly given the subject matter, this is something that could have gone wrong 6 ways to Sunday. But everything went right, as far as I'm concerned. And I think Mark Ruffalo did a wonderful job portraying me. It was really a pleasure to work with him and get to know him. I have to say, a lot of this has to do with the commitment of Tom McCarthy, who really wanted to make an authentic picture. You know, Tom really said this had to be as real as possible. And that commitment translated throughout the film. It translated to the people who were designing the set. It translated to the costume designer, translated to the actors. It was a wonderful notion that Tom had, and he was very, very persistent about pursuing it. And I think that's why in the final analysis, we have a movie that's really incredibly accurate and very, very authentic.
Well, I agree, and I did want to say that I've never seen a film that was about compiling databases and building spreadsheets that was so compelling to watch. And I also think that having now gotten a chance to speak with you, I can say I think Ruffalo did an excellent job with his portrayal, especially in the vocal mannerisms. It's actually kind of uncanny.
yeah, it is. It is uncanny.
Did you get to work with the actor closely? Did he like shadow you or anything like that?
Oh yeah, he came to my house on a Sunday afternoon, and we talked for hours until we got hungry. And there's a nice little Italian restaurant a couple blocks from my house, and we went there and had a nice meal, and we came back to my house, and we talked late into the evening, and Mark also shadowed me at the Globe, I think, for 4 days. He sat at my desk next to me while I interviewed people on the phone, and he really got into the research I was doing. I was in the middle of this Bridgewater investigation when Mark was shadowing me, and I had some video of the death scene of one of the guys who died there as a result of the use of 4-point restraints. And I'd had a tip that there was something wrong with the oxygen tank in this this failed rescue attempt. And so I was trying to see what happened with the oxygen tank in this video that I had. It was very, very low quality, very, very grainy video. And I was going over it and over it. And so suddenly I felt Mark's hand take the computer mouse away from me. And he was going back and forth over the video, really intent on finding out exactly where this botched rescue attempt went wrong. So he just became a very incredibly intense and enthusiastic participant in what I was doing.
It definitely paid off.
Yeah, without a doubt. So here, let me ask you this, because obviously you said they took the entire investigation that took months and compressed it down into 2 hours. The big breakthrough that you guys had obviously was discovering sick leave, the designations that they had for the priests who were removed from parishes for situations. So you guys were gathering all this up, and then and then in the movie, I don't know how accurate it is, you can kind of explain it, but that Robbie had the idea of saying, let's use the directories to identify priests. And so then there was a scene where it showed you guys kind of going through these things, which took about 5 minutes. But how long did it really take for you to go through all those directories, get that loaded into like a database? How long did that all take?
6 weeks of tedious, blinding, mind-numbing work. it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie because, I mean, this was, it was so tedious. And I would think there could be nothing less cinematic than putting that database together. But the way they did it, there was the editor, Tom McArdle, I think, did just a fantastic job. So you see me in a bar going over the directory, and you see Sasha in the library, and you cut to Matt Carroll at home. And, you know, the music is swelling, and it, to me, is just an incredible sequence because it seemed so utterly inspiring, and at the time doing it was just such incredible drudgery.
And did Matt, was there an actual one of those treatment centers right near Matt's home, as was shown in the movie?
No, that was a little literary license. There was such a facility, but it was not in Matt Carroll's neighborhood. It was probably maybe 5 miles away.
Okay.
So that was a bit of literary license. I mean, we told the director and the screenwriter who wrote the script together, Tom McCarthy and Josh Singer, we told them about this facility, and that's how they incorporated it into the film. I mean, this movie is very, very incredibly accurate, but it's not a documentary. And it, as I said, it does compress a 5-month investigation into 2 hours. So there are a lot of shortcuts, and there are composite characters, and there's a lot of conflating of events. You know, for instance, I had two key document halls that were really the backbone of the first and second day story, but they conflate that into one document hall. And, you know, that's because you got 2 hours.
Right.
And they did it in a very, one of the document halls was not so cinematic and the other one was cinematic. So they combined the two document halls into one using the cinematic aspects of the one that was more movie friendly.
And so there, and like, I think, also like something else, like there is no Jim Sullivan, right? There was 5 or 6 lawyers that you guys had spoken to.
He's a composite character. That's right.
Right. Well, and of course, you know, for anybody that knows film, that there's going to be some of that, but I mean, the core story, of course, is what's important. And, you know, from what I've read and what I've read about what you guys have said and what everybody said, that they really did a fantastic job. So, was there anything that you did that maybe even there may have been scenes that were cut or anything? Was there anything that didn't make it into the movie that you kind of hoped that you were a little disappointed that didn't?
Well, no, there's really not. In that particular 5 months, there's really nothing I can think of that was critically important that they didn't get in there. I mean, as I said, we kept going for another year, and there were a lot of incredible things that happened over the course of the year that I think would have worked great in the movie. But, you know, that was their concept, and that was their discipline, which was to restrict the story to the initial investigation. And frankly, you know, I think it was a brilliant way to do it. And if you only got 2 hours, I don't know how you could have done it any other way.
That's true. Now, you know, one of the other things that they did include, I think, was it touched on some of the personal reactions of the reporters, especially in light of, you know, their faith. And I think that was appropriate to include simply because the story itself was, I think, such a it was so directly relevant to so many people's faith and to so many people, I think, worldwide. So I guess I wanted to just sort of ask, you know, ask about the impact that it had on you personally, this investigation. Did it take a toll on you? Did it sort of alter your view of the church? You know, with the distance of years, you know, have you seen improvements in the Catholic Church in that regard? Where do you stand on that?
Well, that's a couple of different questions. You know, personally, the movie does reflect my personal feelings about the Catholic Church. And I think the scene where Sasha is showing the article to her grandmother, I think also highlights the impact that the story had on a lot of very, very devout, faithful, good Catholics. You know, I think it was at the time I kind of resisted any of my personal life being in the movie. In hindsight, I can say I regret that. But at the time, I didn't really think it was appropriate to have any part of our personal lives in the movie. But we had some I wouldn't say friction, but we had some tension over that. And I guess what you see is something of a compromise. But I'm glad that Tom and Josh both listened to me and pushed back. As I say, I in hindsight, I kind of regret the tough stance I took on this issue, because I think they were probably more right than I was.
Well, it is. It's such a fraught issue, and you know, it's an important one. So I think, again, I think it strengthened the overall film to include that perspective.
There's no doubt about it. It enriched the film. It strengthened the film. It made it more real for people. One of the things I like about this movie is that it doesn't show us, at least I don't think it does, as knights in shining armor. I mean, it shows us making mistakes. It shows us, or me, you know, losing my temper. It shows some of the toll the investigation took on our personal lives. And it shows that, you know, we missed the story back in 1996 or whenever it was. So, you know, it really showed some of our flaws. And I think that's good, because we are flawed, and we need to own up to that. And also, I think it just made the movie feel a lot more real to people.
Agreed. So Mike, we're coming into the final segment here. And before we get to our final piece of business, I just wanted to kind of, I know that sort of the Spotlight team is sort of, you know, secretive. So I don't know if you can necessarily discuss any upcoming investigations, but are you guys working on anything really good, cooking up anything good over there at the Boston Globe?
Yeah, I have a major investigation that's going to be published next week, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
And and I know that my colleagues are working on another major investigation that they're hoping to publish before the end of the year. So we have several things on the stove that I think are going to turn out to be very, very powerful pieces of investigative journalism.
All right. Well, stay tuned, folks. Keep your eyes on the Boston Globe.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Next week. My next investigation will be published next week. That's the idea, anyway.
Awesome. So we'll be looking for that, and we'll let people know right here in the show notes. But before we let you go, we do have one more order of business, and Neil, you can kind of.
Yes, we do, Mike. We like to spring a gotcha question on all of our guests. We don't tell you what it's going to be ahead of time, though as an investigative reporter, I'm sure you could have uncovered what it might be. It's a matter, we think, of vital cultural importance, and one on which Jay and I disagree quite vehemently. And so we turn to our guests to help us arbitrate the matter. And so now I put the question to you, Mike Resendiz, which is better? The Beatles or the Rolling Stones?
Well, it all depends on the mood you're in. I mean, I love them both. It just depends on the mood, the frame of mind. But they were both incredible bands. I mean, were the Rolling Stones the best rock band ever? Yeah, they were. But the Beatles were so inventive, so creative, dreamy in so many ways. Listening to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones are two different experiences, and they're both pretty fantastic.
They are indeed, but life is full of hard choices, Mike. If you had to
you're going to a desert island, Mike, and you can only bring one.
That was admirable. Admirable splitting the difference.
It was.
Though,
that was
I have
great.
To say.
That was good. That was very diplomatic.
That was masterful.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a free country, and I actually don't have to make that choice.
Question authority, right?
There he is.
we'll take it as a split decision.
There we go.
All righty.
We'll chalk it up as a tie in our and Neil and I's on little ongoing battle. So.
Okay. Well, you guys fight it out amongst yourself. I'm sure it's a colorful dispute.
We will, and it is, I assure you. Don't worry. But thank you so much, Mike. Okay. It was really a lot of fun talking to you.
Yeah, it was great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay, take care.
You too. All right, everyone. Mike Resendiz of the Boston Globe. He's the Spotlight team, and he's got a big story coming out next week.
People That's right. So, yeah, again, you know, keep your eyes on the Boston Globe, people. Yeah.
And if you haven't seen the movie Spotlight, you should go ahead and watch it. It's on Netflix right now. It really is a good movie. It's just like Neil said,
yes.
I think Sonny Bunch had said that, too. It's like, who could ever think that kind of a movie where they're kind of looking through directories and building spreadsheets could be so compelling. But it was.
Yeah, check it out, folks. And, you know, I'm speaking to you. I am a Catholic here. And so, you know, this was an issue. This is you can't shrink away from the truth of what happened. And I think that was an important part of that episode. And so I really found the movie to be quite a good watch. It was not anti-Catholic. I think, though, the personal opinions of individuals and characters within it may have been critical of the church. I mean, it's not something that you should avoid just because it happens to be about this subject.
Yeah, I agree. It's, you know, I mean, some people might think that, but it really doesn't. It really focuses on the investigation. It does. There's some talk about it, but that's really, it's more about how it affected each of the journalists individually. It's not about an overall slam on the Catholic Church or anything like that. So it's
no, it's not.
Yeah, it was terrific. So, all right. Anyway, folks, we're going to wrap it up. And as always, you know, if you like what you hear, if you've gotten to this point, hey, go to iTunes, leave us a review, leave us a rating. It's awesome. We love it. We got, you know, a whole bunch of new subscribers in the last couple of weeks. We're really happy about that. So, you know, we're going to bring some really good guests in, that kind of stuff. Right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think we've
done. We're going to keep this winning streak alive, Jay.
Yes, we are. We're definitely going to do that. All right, everyone. So I am Jay Caruso. For Neil Dewing, we will see you next time on The Fifth Estate.